From WYPR, I'm Sheila Cast, and this is Maryland Morning. Nurses learn a code of ethics in school. How is that code put to the test in the real world? We asked Dr. Cindy Hilton Rushton, a professor of clinical ethics at Johns Hopkins University, and Laurie Badzik, a nurse attorney and director of the American Nurses Association Center for Ethics and Human Rights. Then we're 5 days into the new year. You may have decided to make a change in your diet. Our nutrition diva, Monica Reinagle, is here to advise you how to keep your resolve. Plus, theater critic Jaywin Russick brings us her review of the musical Diner, based on the Barry Levinson film. It's now up at the Signature Theater in Arlington. And why reply all can be dangerous, and other office etiquette, with Baltimore author Richie Freeman. First news.
I'm Nathan Sterner, and if you were listening to Maryland Morning Live, I'd be bringing you the latest Maryland news right about now. You can catch the live show Monday, Wednesday, and Friday from 9 to 10 a.m. on 88.1 FM in Baltimore and Frederick, 106.9 FM in Ocean City, and online at WYPR.org. For now, you're listening to the Maryland Morning Podcast. Thanks for downloading us. Let's get the show underway.
Good morning. Welcome to Maryland Morning. I'm Sheila Cast. Respect for human dignity, protecting patients' health, advocating for patients' rights. These are just a few of the provisions in the Nursing Code of Ethics. How does that code of ethics play out in the real world? What happens when a nurse's ethics are challenged, and what structures are in place to help nurses care for patients in ways they know they should? Those questions were taken up at a 3-day Nursing Ethics Summit at the Johns Hopkins School of Nursing last August. We spoke then about some of these issues with Dr. Cindy Hilton Rushton, a professor of clinical ethics at Johns Hopkins University School of Nursing. She organized the Ethics Summit. We also spoke by phone with Laurie Badzik, a nurse attorney and a professor of nursing at West Virginia University. I began by asking Professor Badzik what ethical considerations a nurse must weigh in her daily work life.
I think the first three provisions are probably the ones that show up most often in a nurse's practice. And those provisions actually deal sort of with nurse-to-patient interactions.
So most of us aren't that familiar with the Nurse's Code of Ethics, so what are those first three?
Well, the first provision talks about the nurse practicing with compassion and respect, thinking about the inherent dignity, worth, and uniqueness of each person. The second provision talks about the nurse's primary commitment being to the patient, whether that patient's an individual, a family, or a group. And the third provision is the provision that states that the nurse will promote and advocate and protect the health and safety and the rights of the patient.
Dr. Rushton, the media announcement of this Nursing Ethics Summit refers to, quote, the ethical issues that keep nurses up at night, close quote. Give me an example.
There are so many examples of things that keep nurses up at night, ranging from conflicts between what patients want, perhaps what their family wants, and perhaps even what the medical team wants. So an example would be a patient we cared for not long ago who had cancer and had many rounds of chemotherapy and then had a relapse, had another recurrence. And she was faced with a question of, should I pursue more treatment or should I sort of let this disease progress? Well, she had her own views about that, and her children, who she was very sensitive to their concerns, felt she ought to press on. And she wasn't so sure about that. But in the end, she decided to go forward, and she pursued more chemotherapy. And then she had a very serious blood infection. She was admitted to the intensive care unit and didn't have the capacity any longer to speak for herself. Her children disagreed about whether they should press on or not. There was disagreement between the oncologist and the ICU doctor. And the nurse was in the middle of that, trying to understand the perspectives of each of those parties and also trying to figure out, how do I honor this woman? How do we provide ethical care for her in the middle of this kind of conflict? These are everyday occurrences.
Everyday occurrences. Laurie Badzik, does a nurse who's in a hospital or in a private practice have time to think about ethics?
I think they think about ethics a lot I don't know that they actually resolve dilemmas in a hurry, and we hope that they actually think through them. But certainly they're challenged to think about ethics because of the different things, examples like Cinda has given you, as well as other issues that impact their practice. The fatigue of nurses coming into work in situations where there aren't enough nurses. Certainly, you know, they need to, you know, they do think about that because they're faced with it. And then there are other issues such as the, you know, the new electronic health records and social media. So all of these things are impinging upon their practice. So I think they are faced with the issues, so they do think about it. And, you know, they, you know, hopefully, you know, use their code of ethics
Dr. Rushton,
to make decisions around those ethical issues.
Dr. Rushton, the at the summit this week, the Nursing Ethics Summit, how is that going to touch on what we've been talking about?
So the premise of the Nursing Ethics Summit is that nurses are confronted with these issues every day, and that it's an important time. The urgency in our healthcare system for change really requires us to pause and reset our ethical compass and to reflect on how, as a profession, we are going to uphold these important values. So we are, for the first time ever, bringing together a group of nurse ethicists, representatives from our strategic partners, nursing organizations, including the American Nurses Association and nine others, to create a roadmap for 21st century nursing. What is it? What are the qualities and competencies that nurses need to practice ethically now and in the future? How does that translate into clinical practice, into education? And what are the policies and structures that are needed to help nurses practice ethically? And how can we create an evidence base through research to support them to do the right thing in the right way for the right reason?
On WIPR, this is Maryland Morning. I'm Sheila Cass, speaking with Dr. Cinda Hilton Rushton, nursing professor at Johns Hopkins School of Nursing, and with Laurie Badzik, West Virginia University nurse attorney. We're talking about ethical issues that nurses face. Professor Badzik, you direct the American Nurses Association Center for Ethics and Human Rights, and I understand that it's working on an update of the Code of Ethics. Are there gaps? Are there holes in it?
For the most part, the Code of Ethics is in good shape. It's a 2001 Code of Ethics that we are revising, but there are some gaps. You know, healthcare and nursing and medicine are constantly changing. And so, for example, things that were not included in the 2001 Code that have come about are social media and genomics. These are words that, you know, we didn't really use back in the late 90s when we revised that code. And so the new terminology is being inserted into the Code of Ethics in the places that are most helpful to nurses. The other thing that the code does is it, as we revise the code, we're able to clarify areas of the code where the nurses are seeking more information or more help. So, for example, areas like conscientious objection and areas of the code that relate to the nursing's perspective and commitment to the broader society and to global health, which again is an issue that's been around but hasn't really been clarified, are in the new revised code that will come out in 2015.
Does the Affordable Care Act, Obamacare, raise any new issues? You mentioned social media and electronic medical records as sort of new frontiers.
Certainly it does. And the Affordable Health Care Act and, you know, the IOM Future of Nursing Report have changed nursing's perspective and made it even more important for nurses to be leaders in ethical, you know, care so that we can assure that patients get, you know, safe, quality, effective care. And so it does play into it in the sense that, you know, as a whole, overall, the code, you know, is written now more for all nurses in leadership positions as well as at the bedside, those in education and those in research. And so, you know, we continue to clarify that the code is for all groups and that all nurses must work together, which is what's so wonderful and so important about the summit, that we're bringing all of these perspectives together to look at, you know, what are the needs of the future nurse.
Dr. Rushton, what do nursing students learn about ethics in school?
Well, it's quite variable, and that's one of the areas that we're going to focus on. In our own program here at Johns Hopkins, we have just gone through a curriculum revision and making the foundation of ethics much more explicit. In the graduate program, I teach a core course for all of our graduate nursing students that really focuses on giving them the knowledge, the skills, the competence to be able to recognize and respond to ethical issues, to have a process of analyzing what the different points of view are and how we balance these different perspectives. But really importantly, how do we help nurses have the confidence to speak up and speak out once they've recognized that there's a threat to an important ethical principle? How do they work and communicate effectively with patients and families, with their interprofessional colleagues, and with administrators to come to decisions that we can all live with? And clearly, ethical issues often, we find there's not any easy answers. And for that reason, we have to learn how to deal with uncertainty.
We're down to just a minute or so. Dr. Badzik, what do nurses need to make this work? Can you give me a, sort of a short idea to hang on to?
I think that they need exactly what Cinda was saying. They need a mechanism to use as their own process of ethical decision-making to determine what conflicts exist and whether or not they can resolve that conflict on their own. And if they cannot resolve it, then they need to go to the other mechanisms, to their leadership, to their ethics committees, to their colleagues, so that they can deal with these ethical issues. Because what we know is that nurses who are able and have more knowledge about ethics and can move through a process of ethical decision-making experience less distress in their workplace.
Thank you both for talking to us about it.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Dr. Cinda Hilton-Rushton is the Anne and George Bunting Professor of Clinical Ethics at Johns Hopkins University. Laurie Badzik, who grew up in Baltimore, is a nurse attorney and professor of nursing at West Virginia University. We spoke in August. We've got a link to a report that came out of the Nursing Ethics Summit. That's at our website, wypr.org/Maryland Morning. I'm Sheila Cast, ahead on Maryland Morning, how to keep those New Year's diet resolutions. Stay with us on 88.1.
I'm producer Matt Purdy. Go to our website to learn more about the segment you just heard, check out our audio archives, or to join in on the conversation yourself. You can also make a pledge to support local programming like Maryland Morning. That's wypr.org/Maryland Morning.
Morning, everybody. On 88.1, it's Maryland Morning. I'm Tom Hall. Glad you're with us. Coming up, a review of the new musical by Barry Levinson and Sheryl Crow, based on the hit movie Diner. But first, here we are on the first workday of the first full week of the new year, and we've all seen the predictable magazine covers with headlines like New Year, New You, or some variation thereof. Lots of us have resolved to make changes that will improve our health and well-being in 2015, but lots of us will have a very hard time sticking to those New Year's resolutions. Having survived the holiday party season, having allowed ourselves to have that extra piece of pumpkin pie, we now face the sobering reality of needing to turn over a new leaf. Well, for help in that leaf turning, we turn to the nutrition diva Monica Reinagle. She's a licensed nutritionist and author from Baltimore who blogs at quickanddirtytips.com. Happy New Year, Monica. Good to see you.
Happy New Year, Tom.
So we all make these resolutions. Generally, you've written about this on your blog. Tell us what makes a good resolution. A lot of folks, for example, will say, I'm going to exercise more, you know, but that's not necessarily, it's a good idea, but it's not necessarily a great resolution, is it?
That's exactly right. I think that there are three things that make a good, keepable resolution. One is to make it specific. So the resolution that you just mentioned, I'm going to exercise more. Yeah, that's a great impulse, but how do you know if you're actually doing it? What would make that much more likely to succeed would be if you were to put a metric on that. What does that mean to exercise more? Are you going to go to the gym 3 times a week? Are you going to log 10,000 steps a day on your pedometer? You know, what is that going to look like? Because when you put an actual quantity, a specific concrete number around your resolution, then it's easier to tell whether you're keeping it or not. Otherwise, it's too easy to fudge. You know, Well, I got to the gym once this week. I guess that's exercising more than I did in December.
Right. And you also say that they have to be, the goals have to be realistic, but they also really have to, they have to mean something.
Well, I see a lot of people setting themselves up for failure by signing on for these grandiose lifestyle changes that, you know, in which they suddenly start to run every single morning before, you know, in the dark before they go to work, and they give up sugar entirely, and they're not going to drink anymore except on Saturday night, you know, and they bite off so much that, you know, it becomes quickly unsustainable. Sugar is a really common one that people decide, oh, I ate so many Christmas cookies or holiday, you know, sweets, I'm going to give up sugar. Now, as a nutritionist, I certainly can't argue that that would be a good idea, but I do wonder whether you're going to be able to stick to it. I would much rather you cut back on your sugar by, say, a third all year than give up sugar 100% for 2 weeks and then, you know,
and
quickly relapse.
Into,
right. So,
because if you do that and you actually stay, you know, if you eat half the amount of sugar you ate in the previous year, by the end of the year, you're going to, that's a lot of calories you will not have consumed.
That's a profound impact on your health, far more meaningful than not eating any sugar at all for 2 weeks and then, you know, kind of going back. So yeah, you want to make it, I would rather people pick a couple of small but meaningful changes that they're really going to, you know, carry through than all of a sudden becoming a, you know, vegan, you know, raw foodist on January 1st
overnight.
Until January 2nd.
Right, exactly. Now, you also say to be positive, and by that, you're not talking about optimism, although, of course, optimism's a good
that
thing.
That never hurts.
But you say that you should not just eliminate a bad habit, you should replace it with a better habit.
Yes. It is so much easier to commit to doing something new, doing something better, than it is to just focus on abstaining or giving something up. Maybe one of your resolutions is to stop eating dessert every night after dinner. A nicer version of that would be to resolve to have fruit after dinner instead of that sweet. And then you can focus on, let me make sure I stock up on some really nice seasonal fruit to have after dinner tonight. The outcome is the same. You still have given up those sugary desserts, but it's just more likely to succeed when you frame it in a positive habit, positive direction.
Yeah, so you say, I'm going to do this instead of I'm not going to do this.
Exactly.
Yeah, that's cool. Now, you give some examples of good diet resolutions, and they're very specific. One of them is, for example, eat 2 servings of vegetables before 3 p.m. each day. So why the before 3 p.m.?
Okay. So now you see what I did there? It's very concrete.
Yeah, it's very specific.
A specific number of servings, not only that, but before 3 p.m. And there's no magic to eating vegetables before 3 p.m. The reason I do that is that one of the reasons that people have so much trouble eating enough vegetables is they don't start until dinner time. You know, they don't have any vegetables at breakfast, they don't have any vegetables at lunch, and then all of a sudden they're sitting down at 7 p.m. going, good Lord, I've got to get in 5 servings between now and bedtime. Mm-hmm. So it's really just an attempt to front load that a little bit and to concentrate on getting vegetables throughout the day so that you don't have such an unscalable mountain at the end of the day. So that's the only reason.
So, and like vegetables for breakfast, it's like, you know, take off on that old commercial, vegetables, it's not just for dinner anymore. I mean, you can eat them, you know, certainly eat them for lunch, but you could throw them in omelets and stuff in
absolutely
the morning.
Yeah. Or even just put a nice pile of salsa next to your scrambled eggs. That's actually one of my favorite ways to eat eggs. And there you go, a serving of vegetables. Yeah, but it's also just a matter of remembering to think about that when you're ordering your lunch. You know, sub out the fries, get the coleslaw instead, get a side salad, and then you get to dinner and it's like, hey, I can do 2 more servings and I've met my goal for the day.
Yeah, cool. You say to eat fish at least once a week. This is Pope Monica Reinagle III, right? I mean, the Catholics had it right. When I was growing up, we certainly did that every Friday. But that's just, it's a specific thing. Once a week, make sure you have fish. So it's not meat all the time.
Yeah, it doesn't have to be Friday. It can be any night that it works for you. But, you know, there's so many benefits to eating more fish. Although everybody knows that, few of us actually ring that bell. So just make that a concrete goal. Once a week, plan a meal around fish.
Mm-hmm. Switch to a high-fiber cereal. So that's really going to help clean out the system.
Well, why not? You know, this is, again, just a small but meaningful change. If you eat cereal in the morning and it's something that doesn't have a whole lot of fiber, you know, you're missing an opportunity for fiber. It's also not filling you up and keeping you full as long. So one just easy thing you can do in the cereal aisle is to take a second, look at the nutrition facts label on the cereal box and pick one that has at least 5 grams of fiber per serving. It's concrete, it's actionable, it's meaningful.
Mm-hmm. You say to pack your own lunch twice a week, because if you're packing your own lunch, you're going to be less inclined to throw in cookies and Snickers and, you know, a milkshake, right?
Well, yeah, it would be hard to pack a milkshake. I don't know if there were Snickers in my house, I'd probably put them in my brown bag lunch too. But really the idea here is that meals that we eat out in restaurants just tend to be more caloric, both because of the portion sizes and because of the preparation methods. Chefs are usually
focused. They have more sugar, they have more salt.
Exactly. Because the chefs are trying to make it taste good. They don't care how many calories mm-hmm. are in it. So when you're packing your own food, it just tends to be a less caloric, healthier lunch. So if you're used to eating lunch every day in a restaurant, you know, going out for lunch every day, one small change, it can make a big difference. Pack that lunch twice a week.
Monica Reinagle is the nutrition diva. You're listening to Maryland Morning with Sheila Cast on 88.1. I'm Tom Hall. So you talk about some ways to help keep your resolution. One of them is to go on record. You say that if you're public about your resolution, that tends to be a good motivator. And there's some interesting ways of doing that, including some that include financial incentives. How do those work?
One of them is called Diet Bet, and they run a website called dietbet.com. And the idea here is you go on record with your resolution to lose a certain amount of weight by a certain amount of time. Not only that, but you put down a financial stake. And everybody throws that stake into the pot. And at the end of the time period, if you met your goal, and they have ways of checking to see whether you're on track, you split the pot with everybody else that met their goal. If you don't meet your goal, you lose your stake. So this is both a carrot and a stick, right? You don't want to lose the money that you staked, but you actually can make more because not everyone will meet that goal. And people are finding this fabulously motivating. I spoke with the folks that run dietbet.com. They have a couple different ways you can do it. You can do a short-term game, or you can do a long-term game, 6 months, you know, to try to lose, you know, a more significant amount of weight over a longer period of time. And I love that because that's more meaningful than just dropping a bunch of weight in a short period of time and then kind of going back to life as usual. But they say that one trick here is you need to stake enough to make it painful. If you lose, that the higher the stakes of the game, the greater the percentage of winners. So if you're serious, you know, don't play a $40 game, you know, put something on the line that you're really going to be motivated. Otherwise, the penalty just becomes the price of indulging mm-hmm. in, you know, that behavior that you're trying to change.
And so far, more of the people who've ended up have, in fact, met their goal. It looks like this has succeeded for an awful lot of people.
That's right. Well, about a third of the people in a typical game will meet their goal and split the pot. So that means, you know, they're getting more than they put in. But another third of folks, even though they don't actually meet their goal, they make significant progress toward their goal. So they lose their stake. But I got to say, if you're moving in the right direction, that's not exactly losing.
Mm-hmm. Sure. There's another one called stick.com, and that's spelled STICK.com. K, I guess, is the legal shorthand for contract.
That's right.
So this is you actually sign a contract that says I will lose mm-hmm. X amount of...
This is the brainchild of an economist and lawyer from Yale University named Ian Ayers, and he wrote a great book called Carrots and Sticks. And if you're trying to do some behavior change, it's a very readable, entertaining book, and it's got a lot of insights as to how people can motivate themselves to succeed. But this website, you sign a contract, and you put down a certain amount of money that you will lose if you don't make your goal. So there's no carrot here. It's only stick.
All right.
And then you ask somebody to referee for you. And then there's a funny little twist on it. If I fail to make my goal and I lose my stake, I can tell you ahead of time, I give you my credit card number ahead of time. And I also tell you a charity that I want you to send that money to. Or if you want to be really dastardly, you can nominate what they call an anti-charity, which is a group that you would hate to send money to.
But if you lose,
but
you
if
have
you lose,
to.
That money goes there, right? And people hold themselves to the fire. The only caveat I would have to these kinds of games, you know, is to make sure that you think a little bit about what happens when you meet your goal, when you win your prize, when you, you know, accomplish your thing. Because when the penalty or the reward is removed from the equation, you may find somehow that it's harder to maintain that behavior. So there's nothing that says that you can't sign a maintenance contract that just says I signed this contract that I will continue this behavior for another 6 months or a year. And then next January, we won't have to have this conversation.
Well, this is really fun. I mean, new meaning to the term or the phrase, put your money where your mouth is.
You bet.
That's really quite something. But you do say that, you know, if you go on Facebook and say, okay, everybody, I've decided I'm going to lose 10 pounds, it's a good motivator.
It is. And, you know, it doesn't even have to be public, Tom. Just the act of writing down your resolution on a piece of paper that maybe only you see, folded up and put in your wallet, even that can incrementally increase your chances of sticking to it.
Monica Reinagle, she is the Nutrition Diva. She's a licensed nutritionist from Baltimore and the creator of the Nutrition Diva podcast. She's written 6 books. That's how she stays so trim. She's so busy writing books she can't eat. The latest of which is called Nutrition Diva's Secrets for a Healthy Diet. Monica, good to see you and Happy New Year.
Thanks, Tom.
It's Maryland Morning with Sheila Cast. I'm Tom Hall. Theater critic J. Wynn Russick is on her way to tell us about Barry Levinson's new musical. Stay with us. So it's a new year, and there's a brand new musical by Barry Levinson and Sheryl Crow. Diner is at the Signature Theater in Arlington, Virginia. Our theater critic, J. Wynn Russick, has been to see it. Happy New Year. How you doing?
Happy New Year, Tom. Doing well.
So this is a 1982 famous movie by Baltimore's own Barry Levinson, Diner. Is it an unlikely subject for a musical? In a way, it seems like it might be a bunch of guys sitting around a diner.
Exactly.
How do you get them to sing? You
know? Exactly. how do you get them up out of their diner seats? The movie, I'm sure you remember, takes place in 1959 in, of course, Baltimore. And as you say, not much happens. These are a bunch of guys in their 20s, and they're basically sort of waiting for their lives to begin. One of them will take a bet on anything. One of them is married. One of them's in grad school. Another is about to get married in a few days, but only if his fiance can pass a test about football. But mostly they just sit around and they talk about sports and sex, and they argue about trivia. But Diner is a likely source for a musical in the sense that so many Broadway musicals these days are adapted from movies. I mean, this season alone, Honeymoon in Vegas is about to open in a few weeks, and Finding Neverland opens in March. Diner was Barry Levinson's directorial debut, and it was a movie, Tom, that the studio didn't even want to release. I mean, we love it in Baltimore, but it's become more of a cult classic. It's mostly famous because it made a lot of people famous, Kevin Bacon, Ellen Barkin, Mickey Rourke. But I don't know if you remember this, but there was a lot of period music in the movie.
Yeah.
Jerry Lee Lewis, Bobby Darin, Elvis. So in that sense, it is a likely source.
And speaking of music, of course, the score is by Sheryl Crow, one of several pop stars who's gotten into music theater. We had Sting, we had Elton John, we had people like that.
Cyndi Lauper.
Yeah, Cyndi Lauper, right? But Sheryl Crow has never written a Broadway score before. I mean, do her songs have that 1950s feel to them?
They really do. It's a very strong score, and it captures rock and roll and even rockabilly and doo-wop and jazz and country. There's one song that sounds very much like Burke Bacharach. There's a male doo-wop quartet that gets their own song and sings backup. There's a girl group trio that sings backup. And there's some very strong voices in the cast. Josh Grassetti, who has a really wide range, and Aaron C. Finley, who has that teen heartthrob voice. There's an expendable song in the middle of the second act about what lies ahead and what might have been that I felt sort of slowed things down. But the opening song sets the pace. It's a real lively number. It had me worried a little at first because the lyric is a little too close to Time Warp from the Rocky Horror Show. But it does a very good job of establishing the camaraderie among the diner guys.
The night is calling and it's what the hell, so look to the left, look to the right. Ain't no accident, we're here tonight.
So that's the cast of the Signature Theater's production of Diner. Now, Judy, you've often said that to succeed for these kinds of things, a musical adaptation really needs to change or improve on its sources. So we have this famous, you know, as you say, cult movie, but does it get improved on as a musical?
Well, it's very interesting. This, besides being Sheryl Crow's first musical, it's Barry Levinson's first musical. And it's very interesting that he chose to collaborate with a female songwriter and a female director and choreographer, Kathleen Marshall. because one of the main changes is that they beefed up the women's parts. In the movie, you never see the face of the Elise, the young woman who's about to get married if she passes that football test.
The famous football test.
Exactly. Here, she's one of three women in the diner guys' lives, and they all get significant parts. And one of the best songs, Tear Down This House, is a real cry of pain sung by the wife of the one married guy. And it also has one of Sheryl Crow's most poignant lyrics. Shame on you mothers who choose wedding colors but don't tell you what's really in store. I couldn't imagine, I have to say, how increasing the women's parts would work in a show that was basically about guys. But the women really illuminate aspects of the men's characters, or maybe aspects that are missing, partly because the women all seem smarter and more sensitive and more mature. And there's one other major change. The musical has a narrator, an actor who plays an older version of Boogie, the guy who will bet on anything and everything. And I think narrators can be a crutch, but this one works fairly smoothly. It's used more to set the scene than to fill an exposition.
Well, I love Sheryl Crow, and of course that lyric is an example of the kind of thing that has been so appealing about her for so many years. Let me ask a very basic, perhaps really stupid question, but is the set a diner?
Oh, yes. And the diner is really a character in its own right. It's designed by Derek McLean, and here's how important it is. The red vinyl diner banquettes even show up in other scenes, in a scene in a strip club, in a scene in jail. These guys just can't get away from the diner. Now, I should say the human characters, it's not just the set that's a character, the human characters are also very well portrayed. With the exception, I felt, of an actor named Matthew James Thomas, who takes the Kevin Bacon role of the alcoholic rich boy. Thomas never quite seemed convincing as a real ne'er-do-well to me. Kathleen Marshall, director and choreographer, has created some masculine choreography. The second song, What Would You Bet, has some real athletic moves that show the physical interaction among the guys. They mime playing basketball. They toss a ketchup bottle around. They're just guys horsing around.
Sure as a penny hits the wall. Sure as the umpire makes a call. Sure as the racket hits the ball. What would you bet? I bet it all.
That's What Would You Bet from Signature Theater's production of the new musical by Barry Levinson and Sheryl Crow. So, Javen Rusick, what would you bet that this show will eventually end up on Broadway? It's been taking a couple of years to get it going. They announced this, you know, a couple of years ago. Do you think it'll make it to New York?
Well, Signature Theater has a pretty good track record of sending shows to New York, and I attended a regular performance during the week, not the opening. The audience just loved it. I heard people say they wanted to see it a second time.
Well, that bodes well.
Absolutely. The show is sold out, I should mention, but you never know. You can call the box office, maybe get last-minute cancellation. So Broadway, I would say it's a pretty good bet.
All right, start spreading the news. Theater critic Javen Rusick, many thanks. See you soon.
Thank you, Tom.
The Signature Theater is presenting Diner by Barry Levinson and Sheryl Crow over in Arlington, Virginia. It's there through the 25th of January. Come to our website. We'll link you up with them, wipr.org/Maryland Morning. It's Maryland Morning. I'm Tom Hall. Stay with us.
I'm producer Matt Purdy. Do you have thoughts on that segment you just heard? Email us at mdmorning@wipr.org or find us on Twitter. We are at Maryland Morning. Now, back to the show.
Welcome back. It's Maryland Morning with Sheila Cast. I'm Tom Hall. You know, as most people jump back into the post-holiday regular work rhythm, we thought it'd be a good time to revisit a conversation I had last year about the do's and don'ts of workplace etiquette. Richie Freeman is an etiquette guru. His book, Reply All and Other Ways to Tank Your Career, takes up the delicate nuances of etiquette in the workplace. We spoke last February. So let's start right with the title. What happens if you make that horrible mistake that many people have made and others know people who have made, where you send what is supposed to be a personal email and you mistakenly hit reply all and there it goes to the whole company or to a whole group of people?
Well, first thing happens is the color washes out from your face.
Yeah.
Your stomach drops. But, you know, after that, it's I tell people it's about covering your bases and really admitting to what you did. Unfortunately, there's two sides. Is it an email that was pleasant, which is just, you know, I didn't mean to send it to everybody, or did the email have something in it that was had any form of that would go against your personality or your character? And those are two areas you got to cover up pretty quick. So own up, reply back, and say, look, apologize about the last email. You know, it only meant to go to so-and-so. And then don't bring it up. People start to dwell on it. And if you keep dwelling on it, people always remember it. And then it becomes a bigger thing. Like, oh, yeah, remember, look, the other day, remember when I did that? I'm sorry. Next thing. Oh, yeah, look, remember the other day when I did that? Last week? It's like, drop it. Get over it.
So move on.
Move on. That's it.
Well, you have a variety of different subjects that you cover in the book. One of them is dating in the workplace, which is obviously full of minefields. And I'm actually interested that you describe it at one point as inevitable that people will date in the workplace. And that's, I'm not so sure it is inevitable. I mean, everyone around here just wants to date Nathan Sterner. But other than that, you know, it's I think, generally speaking, under control, at least at WYPR. But is that common that people are dating in the workplace all the time?
Well, I say it's inevitable in the fact that if you look at your day, you look at your life throughout the week, how much time are you really spending at work and how much time are you spending in a social environment? The workday wins. You're spending the majority of your week at work.
Yeah, by a lot.
By a lot. And very rarely do you venture out to do social things in large hour spans, for example. Yeah, you know, like you might go to a restaurant, you meet up with friends, but you're surrounded by people you see day in, day out, and you discover more people in a large building or a large office. People are coming in. You become very close with them. You become personal. They become your like second family almost. And from that standpoint, it's easy to have a relationship or have a relationship with somebody that knows somebody in the office, a friend, a sister, a brother, a cousin that wants to set you up, for example. But that brings it also into the office as well.
Yes, Stephanie Hughes, our producer, is saying, yep, that happens. She's giving you a thumbs up.
Yeah.
So good idea, bad idea? I mean, is it something you should just avoid at all costs? I mean, keep your work life and your social life completely separate?
You know, I like to think I'm a romantic at heart, and I believe that if you find romance at the workplace, go for it 100%. But what I also tell people, though, in the book is that you have to be really mature about it and understand that by making that step of having a relationship with somebody that you work with, what is going to happen because of it? This is not a time to have a fling. This is not a time to add another notch to your belt or anything. You have to realize that if something bad happens, you know, you have to see this person day in and day out. So can you handle that? And can you be upfront when you first start dating? Say, look, let's say things go bad. We have to promise each other that we're going to still be professional. We can do our job.
Dating's complicated enough.
Oh,
and then if you add the workplace thing on top of it, it can be tough. You write, end the book on a hopeful note. In your epilogue, you talk about an etiquette renaissance, you know, and in the world that seems in so many ways to be just full of, you know, sort of caustic discourse, you're saying that actually manners are not so passe and people are really embracing the idea of proper etiquette and respect for each other. That's good to hear.
I mean, I like to think so. And what I tell people is that I say manners is on a renaissance. But in that aspect is that people think manners and etiquette is, you know, white glove, Downton Abbey, a large dinner display and things like that. And they're very intimidated. So they think that that is the only way that I can meet, quote, etiquette or be, quote, mannerly. But it's not at all. It's simple things about showing respect to the person next to you, holding the door open for them, you know, even helping them if they've dropped their bag, pick it up for them, saying thank you, please and thank you. My God, I mean, you would think these things have, like, you know, gone the age of the dinosaur, but those little words help. And when you realize and you get out in the real world and you see people that annoy you and that are being so rude, you see people in pop culture, for example, that are just doing things so outlandish, it's more popular now and you start to pick up on it and say to yourself, I don't want to be like that person. I don't want to be around that person. So you flip your own mental switch and tell yourself, I'm going to start treating people better, start doing things here and there. It's little steps, and it's cool. I mean, at the end of the day, it's your reputation. It's your reputation is what matters and how you treat people. They'll remember that. And that's what I like to tell people.
Yeah, and it's the right thing to do. Now, you came to this job as the manners guy from a variety of different places, including being a professional wrestler. That's amazing to me. You were called the Thrill from Israel, Buster Maccabi, and you actually wrestled. How long did you wrestle?
I wrestled for about 8.5 years.
So a big chunk of your career.
Yeah, I mean, I was doing a lot of things while I was wrestling, too. I mean, the world of professional wrestling isn't exactly the fanciest of things in the world. But I would do it on the weekends, and I would train during the week, and we would travel on the weekends as well. So it was an absolute awesome, amazing time in my life.
So how do you do the transition from wrestler of all things to manners? That's, I mean, of the two things, you know, you couldn't guess the two things that are more binary in their outlook.
You know, it's just a part of my personality. I like to think I got many layers, and a lot of people do as well. So It's how I take things that I enjoy and take things that I find to be interesting. I just happen to really go after those things and try to see other avenues for me to pursue them. Wrestling was one of them. I'm 5'5" and 150 pounds. When I wrestled, I was maybe about 15 pounds heavier. I was working out like crazy. But I know everybody told me, of course, I could never be a wrestler. But, you know, I tried. It worked. It fit my personality. But at the same time, I was doing children's books and I was doing entrepreneurial things. And there were things about my personality that I always wanted to do. And I said, well, let's give it a shot and see if it works. And it's just another layer.
That's pretty wild. Well, I really enjoyed meeting you. Thanks for coming in. And good luck with Manners and in your post-wrestling career.
Thank you very much. I appreciate the time.
Richie Freeman, his book is called Reply All and Other Ways to Tank Your Career. We spoke last February. We've got a link to more information about the book on our website, WIPR.org/Maryland Morning. We'll also have a link there to information about his new novel. It's set in Baltimore. It's called Where the Heart Left Off. It's Maryland Morning. I'm Tom Hall. Thanks for being with us. Have a great day.
Maryland Morning is an original production
of your public radio,
WYPR,
in Baltimore.
Our producers are Matt Purdy, and today we welcome new Maryland Morning producer, Jonna McCone.
Nathan Sterner directs and engineers.
On this day in Maryland history, in 1886, the central branch of the Enoch Pratt Library opened on Mulberry Street in Baltimore. Within 3 months, the library opened 4 more branches. I'm Sheila Cass. Thanks for listening this morning. Back with you Wednesday.